Hello and welcome to ESPN Cricket Info's Talking T20 podcast. My name is Alex Malcolm and on today's episode we'll be discussing all things Big Bash. The BBL has been the longest in tournament history. There's a number of issues that have arisen from that, and to take a deep dive into it, I'm joined by two of our BBL correspondents, Assistant Editor of ESPN Cricket Info and noted author Dan Bredig. Welcome, Dan.
Great to be here, mate.
And ESPN Cricket Info's BBL columnist and a member of the Great Cricketer podcast, amongst many other hats that he wears. Sam Perry, nice to have you with us.
Absolute honour.
Let's start with the elephant in the room, the elephant that has from trunk to tail spanned 59 days. As I mentioned in the intro, it's been the longest tournament in the eight-year history of the BBL. The opening match was on December 19. The final will be on February 17. Before I ask your thoughts, I just wanted to put this into the context using one player. Sandeep Lamachani played the opening four matches for the Melbourne Stars this season. He then went and played six games for the Sylhet Sixers in the Bangladesh Premier League before playing three ODIs and three T20 internationals for Nepal and the UAE, and he was still able to come back and play the last two home and away games for the Stars and the finals, which is just extraordinary. So he played 12 matches in the Northern Hemisphere for two teams in two countries across two formats, six internationals and six in a domestic league. In the same time, it took the Stars to play eight BBL games. So the length of the tournament. What are your thoughts, Dan?
First thought is that given Australia's recent history, I'm surprised we've had just the one Prime Minister throughout this entire tournament. Given the headlines in the last few days, I don't know. Will Scott Morrison see it out through the semis in the final? We wait to see. But look, I think the number of days, the size of the footprint of the tournament, it's clearly something that can change and probably will change. It's not necessarily the number of games, you know, divided by the number of days. And I don't think necessarily the problem of the tournament is that there are too many matches. And I don't think that players talking about being fatigued is necessarily to do with the number of matches per se. It's the amount of time they're spending in camp. It's a little bit like, some players have compared it a little bit like a World Cup when it's been in the long, long format that the 50 over World Cup can have, where teams have quite big gaps between days, but you've got to sort of stay on a fairly high kind of plateau of readiness and intensity, even though you're not playing, and that can wear you down over time. And also just the fact that the footprint in terms of before school holidays into and after, I think while Cricket Australia are very committed to extending it into, or keeping it extended into mid-February, it's the start of it and maybe not starting it till Boxing Day that might happen.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree, Dan. I think most of the tone of the conversation about the BBL this year has been that it has been too long, though I too think that's a slightly oversimplified argument. We do know kind of cynically in Australia that we do struggle with change at times. It has been like a very strange year for Australian cricket, and I do think a lot of the Australian audience understand the Big Bash in relation to our national team, which has just kind of been torn asunder this year. We sort of understand the Big Bash as this fun thing that you can turn on with, you know, very little context and enjoy it while the national team does the serious business. But I think since we've had the cultural review, which has kind of found Australian cricket to be in all sorts, that it's dysfunctional, the BBL kind of stands as this symbol almost, I think, of Cricket Australia greed. So I think the dual issue of the national team struggling this year alongside the BBL being on and there being such poor quality matches has led many people to conclude that the BBL is the villain, through all of it. I do think it's an evolving product, for want of a warmer term. I do think that they'll get it better. I don't think it's necessarily too long. I just think that the quality of the games and the few last over finishes that we've seen has exacerbated this idea that it has kind of failed a little bit.
I don't disagree with that. I do think they can tighten it. The example I went and had a look at, the IPL in 2018, same number of teams, started on April 7, finished on May 27. So that was 51 days. They had one extra final. Right. So they were able to reduce it by 8 days. The question is, the broadcasters play a big part in this. They want one game per day because that suits them. Now, if you go and have a look at next year's calendar, there's talk, Dan, and you've reported on this, that the BBL may start on Boxing Day. If you extrapolate out, one game per day takes you to February 25. So the broadcasters have to come to the table here. There needs to be double headers in order to fit it into a compacted schedule. What's the solution?
Well, I tend to look at it as this is now a kind of hybrid between a, well, what it was in Australia is a 2020 tournament that sat within a larger summer and a league like footy, like the AFL or the NRL or something like that, where the volume of games means that it is unrealistic to expect that you just run it one game per night. I mean, even one of the comparisons that, that could be made is, say, like a FIFA World Cup, where you have generally three, sometimes four matches a day during the group phase, so that is tight, and then you stretch it out when you get to the pointy end of the tournament. I think that something that needs to be discussed in a realistic way by the broadcasters with Cricket Australia is, as the tournament grows, because naturally Cricket Australia want the tournament and the teams to attract genuine club followings, not just necessarily the sort of initial kind of sugar hit for the Big Bash League, which was that everyone watches every game because it's something fun to watch and they don't really care which teams. They want audiences to align to teams. Therefore, you do get into an AFL situation where you do have games on in different markets at the same time, and you should be able to cope with that because otherwise the games don't fit.
Yeah,
I mean, I can't say that I'm sort of a scheduling expert in relation to that kind of stuff. I don't think I would have spoken with anywhere near as much detail as you might have, Dan, with our guys at the pointy end of these discussions. Suffice to say that, like, I do think we can forget about the first principles of the BBL, which is that they just want it to always be on. So I think, like, regardless of doubleheaders or whatnot, I mean, the aim should be that you do turn on your TV and there is cricket to watch, as contextless, as it is.
Yeah.
However they arrange that, and I think that they will, and I don't think that Cricket Australia have been, to be fair to them, have been pig-headed about the way that it is formatted. I mean, I think they've been open about saying we will tighten, we will continue to change it. And I would expect next year that it does look a little bit different, and they do kind of answer, at least in part, some people's complaints from this year.
Yeah, I think, and we might get onto it a little bit later, but the point was made today that the nature of the end of this tournament means that a lot of the international Australian players are actually available during an international free window. But we might touch on that a little bit later. One of the other issues that has arisen, particularly in light of what's happened in Bangladesh, they've had some superstars go and play in the Bangladesh Premier League in a shortened tournament with a lot more money on offer for those guys. And the issue within the BBL has been attracting high-quality overseas players. The Renegades will be without Mohammad Nabi. They'll only have one overseas player for their final. There's a few other issues. Tom Curran's left the Sixers as well. Only two players per team in Australia, for those that don't know. The salary cap is an issue. There's only a salary cap of $1.675 million for each team. That'll increase to $1.75 next year and it'll get up to $1.9 by BBL 11, so 2021-22. But one of the issues for Cricket Australia to look at, and the BBL in general, is how do they attract the better players and how do they attract more overseas players potentially to fit into teams, and whether that's going to better the product or affect the development of Australian players. Have you got any thoughts on that?
It's something that demonstrates to you that the BBL up to a point has been within the control of Cricket Australia's various departments, whereas, whether it's marketing or advertising or scheduling or strategy, whatever those are. But one area in which the BBL is at the mercy of something outside of Cricket Australia's control is the international schedule and the availability of overseas players who, if you by definition are playing a tournament opposite your own international cricket, they become the best high-profile names on offer. So I think there does need to be some pretty serious thought about Cricket Australia taking a more collective approach to attracting overseas players to play and remunerating them accordingly in, acknowledgement of the fact that the marketplace around the world is now presenting opportunities for players to be paid more than they can possibly get in the BBL to play less. So if you look at that market reality, then I think Cricket Australia probably needs to use one of the things to its advantage, which is that overseas players are not signatories of the MOU, meaning that there are many different ways by which they can be paid, and probably the suggestion that I've heard from within the BBL clubs that I think has the most merit is if Cricket Australia has a separate pool of money for these overseas players in the off-season, approaches them not to specifically play for any team, but say, come and play in the BBL, we can offer you X amount, and then you have a draft. You have a draft for the overseas players, divided up among the eight clubs, you know, perhaps according to their ladder positions the previous year, and then you get an even distribution of players who are paid what their international market value is, and also you get an increase for what's available to the domestic players if the cap doesn't change, because they stay within the MOU umbrella.
I'm sure they can create structures to be able to pay some of these overseas players more. I mean, I think this is a big issue, and I don't mean to, I write about grade cricket, but I don't mean to talk it down, but there certainly have been occasions, without naming any particular players or teams or whatnot, where you do watch the Big Bash League, or I have watched it this summer and felt as though each team has four or five seasoned professional kind of international level T20 players, and there's a feeling that the remainder of the teams are made up by guys less so, I guess, and given that it's meant to be a bit of a golden child of Cricket Australia, and I'm making another presumption that Cricket Australia is quite cash rich. You know, Dan, you can provide more info on that than I can. But
You work at Channel 7, mate.
Yeah, let's not talk about traditional media. it does boggle the mind a little bit that more money isn't made available for high-level players, and that Australian cricket is kind of losing out to, with respect, you know, Pakistan and Bangladesh cricket for some of these players. It doesn't hold water to me that it's about protecting the development of junior players necessarily. I would welcome Cricket Australia kind of creating a little bit more money or opportunity for the better players to be here.
It's one thing else that has been raised in recent times is that in the last television deal or broadcast deal signed between Foxtel and the A-League, there was a specific pool of money that Fox put in specifically for overseas marquee players. Now, obviously, in terms of the deals that have just been struck last year with Fox and Seven West Media, that wasn't included. But if you think about the sorts of television audiences and therefore advertising revenue being drawn in by the Big Bash League and by the Australian cricket season entire to those broadcasters relative to the A-League, I'm sounding like Malcolm Conn here, but that's okay, surely there would be scope to have a bit of a rethink about those broadcasters saying, well, you know, in the scheme of a large agreement over a course of 6 years, tipping in a little bit of extra money specifically for that purpose, which then has obviously benefits for the broadcasters in the long run, might not be a particularly ridiculous conversation to have.
Well, I'll put a number to it. So AB de Villiers played in the Bangladesh Premier League. There was some talk, or there has been whispers around the place, that certainly last year, I think when de Villiers gave up his, retired from international cricket, that maybe he would come and play in the BBL. He signed a short-term contract with the Rangpur Riders in the BPL. He played six matches. He was paid $360,000 US for six matches, which Australian is 500 grand, which is 29% of the 18-man salary cap. So no team can afford that. Plus, the length of the tournament is another issue. Johan Botha has retired from the BBL with four games to go, won't play in the finals because he's coaching in the PSL for the Moulton Sultans. And there's been an incident late last week where Colin Ingram was relieved of the last game for the Adelaide Strikers, saying he needed to go home. He's playing for the Karachi Kings. Karachi played Moulton on Friday night, which is 2 days out from the final in Dubai. So there's a lot to go into it, including what we just discussed, which was the length of the tournament as well. It's a big commitment for guys to come out here for two full months.
Yeah, and like, I don't think there'd be too many concerns among fans. You know, one of the stakeholders of the game were players to not be able to spend the whole tournament at the BBL. But when we're talking about the reasons why these guys can't stay for too much longer, or they will not come to the BBL, it does just come down to their pay, does it not? I mean, I hate to be cynical about it, and it just,
it's their core business.
Yeah, I mean, the mechanisms by which you get them here via money, I think, are surely solvable. So I am struggling to you know, think to think of the reasons why the salary cap has to be the way that it is.
And just the basic arithmetic of the broadcast deals that were signed last year. In 2013, the deal with Channel 9 and Channel 10 for international cricket in the Big Bash League, the value of the Big Bash League was about a sixth of the total deal. Whereas, and you know, there's no actual quantification of this because it was a bit of a hodgepodge, obviously, between the two networks sharing the BBL. But basically, it's worth about half of the $1.2 billion that was paid overall. Now, there's absolutely no correlation between that and what the salary cap is. Yeah. So, and I understand in terms of the levers of cricket administration, what Cricket Australia wants strategically to achieve out of the Big Bash League, they don't want to then create a situation where it's as lucrative to play Big Bash as it is to play for Australia. That's nowhere near what they want to be doing. But you can't sustain, I don't think, the idea that you can keep the Big Bash salary levels on the plane that they are at the moment while reaping a massive deal over six years.
That's interesting. So if I understand that correctly, Cricket Australia might foresee an issue in relation to the prestige of both tournaments or of both options. So are you saying that Cricket Australia is worried if you put too much money into that tournament that it will become more like sort of desirable to play in that than even play for Australia? Perhaps, well, I think protecting the international.
Yeah, I think they put it the other way. Yeah. You know, the word you always hear relating to international cricket, and you never hear it used about almost anything else, is primacy. Yes. And protecting the primacy of international cricket, and that too many 2020 leagues offering too much money for too little cricket relative to international cricket shortens international careers, and AB de Villiers obviously is a signal example of that. So, Cricket Australia are trying to balance the amount of money they get entirely for the broadcast of cricket in Australia with what strategically they want to be doing to best grow the game as they see, you know, international cricket being the most important thing, followed by domestic and T20 cricket alongside that.
Bottom line about below all of this is the quality of the cricket. As you've mentioned, Sam, so the standard of the pitches has been the biggest issue. Talking to the players, talking to administrators, talking to the coaches, and you've done quite a bit of this during the tournament, Sam, with your work as a columnist. Marvel Stadium is a particular issue, so too Spotless. They've played a couple of games at out venues. Maui Launceston's been okay this season. Gold Coast was an interesting one. We have a great BBL stats piece, which is worthwhile having a look at if you're listening to this, from Barrett Servi. It's on the ESPN Cricket Info website under the BBL page. This season is the first time since 2012-13 no team has scored 200 in innings. It's the only T20 tournament in the world this year out of 39 where that has happened. The overall run rate, 7.81, second lowest for batting teams in BBL history behind 2012-13. And the middle overs run rate of 7.43 is the lowest in the competition's history. So, Sam, I'll start with you. How do the players and the teams feel about the standard of pitches this year, and how much has that contributed to the poor standard of play?
Mm. I'm glad that stats piece was written because, you know, we always had the feel that there weren't that many runs being scored this year and that the quality was low, but you sort of get worried that someone's going to come up with the stats piece that just completely confounds that. Mm. Yeah, so I'm very, very happy that exists. Yes, certainly speaking to a lot of the players, that's definitely the widely held view. A lot of them will say it on background, you know, and don't want to say it in person. But, I mean, let's talk about Marvel Stadium, for example, which will be hosting a semi-final in a couple of days as we go to air. You know, a couple of players who play for them have been, Kane Richardson was a guy I spoke to, and he was happy to say this on the record, that, you know, I think I was trying to praise him, and he's now in the ODI squad. But I was praising his bowling, his leading wicket taker. I was asking, you know, what's his secret kind of thing? Because, you know, in an age of wrist spinners and guys having three or four different balls that they deliver, he didn't look like he really had that. And he said, look, I do think I'm lucky to play at Marvel Stadium, where I can essentially bowl back of the length, slower balls. I have one or two that I bowl. I'm sure batsmen will pick it soon enough, and I'm going to have to come up with another one. But he thought that the wicket had been very advantageous to him, not just in terms of being able to take wickets, but also batsmen not being able to kind of get away You know, in Australia, almost more than anywhere else, you know, we have this addiction to the ball flying. You know, we love seeing the ball fly wherever we go. Everything has to be fast and hard and whatnot. But all of the, so many wickets in the BBL have surfaces that like fundamentally withdraw pace from the ball as it hits the wicket. And it does make for a style of cricket that is anathema to the ball flying. You know, all of a sudden you've got, you know, Matt Renshaw opening the bowling and bowling the ball into the wicket just to withdraw all the pace from it. You know, Jono Wells, with respect to Jono Wells, who's a very good batsman, especially for the T20 purists, you know, I've seen enough of him nurdling the ball around, you know, from over sort of 7 to 14. Again, respect to Jono, but it's the wickets produce this kind of cricket. And I do think that of all of the drop-down items contributing to our sense that the BBL hasn't been as strong this year, I do think the wickets is probably number one. The few highlights, not enough.
Yeah, the creation of the right environment for players to play the sort of cricket that'll bring the crowds in. I mean, it's interesting to me that this is widespread enough of an issue in the BBL relative to something that we've seen in Australian cricket in the last 4 or 5 years with day-night test cricket and the degree to which, you know, the testing that took place to work out, well, which venue is going to be able to create the right environment for that to make sure that it works, which was obviously Adelaide Oval and to a lesser extent the Gabba. So, you know, the amount of thinking and the amount of money being spent and strategising and discussing shows that there is a... There's clearly within the governing body of Australian cricket a awareness that that's critical to creating the right environment for the game to be played in certain formats. But I think probably with the Big Bash League, this is a symptom of, it is a symptom of growing pains, you know, expanding the number of venues, which Cricket Australia are always very big about in terms of they want to get the game out to the people. And then the broadcasters are okay with that because it's still, you know, they're less concerned about the, you know, the gate receipts if they're at a 5,000 seater venue rather than a 20,000 seater venue, provided it's good TV product. But the pitches, haven't been to that standard and that calls for a bit of a rethink, perhaps in terms of, well, if we're going to expand the number of venues, let's make sure the venues that are our, you know, core ones are the best they can possibly be first.
One of the challenges for the administrators is that they don't have particular control over the curators at the venues. And that's one of the biggest issues that they've got. And the curators are simply doing the best that they can with the facilities that they've got. And a number of the players and the coaching staffs are going up to the curators at the new venues that are there and asking how the wicket's going to play. And the curators are saying, well, we don't really know, which is a big issue. I do think there is a case to be made that, and this might be a wider issue, that Australian batting standards probably aren't at the level. There's not that much experience around to handle playing on really low, slow wickets. It's funny, Sam, you and I come from a grade cricket background. I don't think enough of these guys are actually playing enough grade cricket because a lot of these games are played like grade cricket. The BPL had an issue this year, Bangladesh Premier League, with the standard of pitches. They played on a lot of tired wickets. They played on surfaces 2-3 times over in a week and scoring dropped significantly as a result. And players of the quality of David Warner and AB de Villiers still found it quite difficult. De Villiers made 50 ball 100 one innings, but he didn't completely dominate in the six games that he played. Warner had his moments. So there's a balance to be found. I wouldn't necessarily want all of our players to completely blame the surfaces entirely, but it's something that obviously needs to be fixed moving forward.
I think you're definitely right, and I think it is worth clarifying because I'm sure some listeners' ears might be burning, saying, well, if batsmen are struggling, perhaps the bowling is good or whatnot. I think the broader point is that low, slow wickets that have very little life for the ball once it actually hits the surface, it encourages a style of cricket that is less attractive than otherwise. So there are still people who are quite good at, and we've said, you know, we've discussed some of the bowlers who can actually adapt really well to those wickets. It certainly makes for batting that doesn't encourage perhaps, say, hitting the ball across the line, for example. It encourages guys to take the single to long on, to stay in. It encourages, you know, match-winning innings become kind of those with strike rates fractionally above a runner ball who might be able to string together a couple of sixes at the end. And we know, having watched a lot of T20 cricket over the last decade globally, that there is a way to play cricket far more exciting than that. And it is difficult as a fan or somebody, as an observer, to understand, you know, how much these wickets can actually impact the excitement of the game. So, you know, I'd love to know, you know, whether they can put in more resources to create wickets that will attract, you know, encourage that brand of cricket.
Well, and also it's the wickets multiplied by the fact that 2020 is now so much more tactically advanced, so much more analysed by individual teams that, you know, the defensive skills of the game in the field and with the ball, they are so much more enhanced by that sort of a pitch that, you know, it becomes a chess match in terms of where the bowlers are putting the ball, and the batsmen having a little bit less of the advantage that they have on a, you know, a good wicket with a decent amount of pace, where they can just hit through it, and that leaves, ironically enough, in a game that was devised for batsmen, really, leaves things a little bit out of balance in terms of the primary skill that's meant to entertain the crowds.
It all comes down to margin of error, and the margin of error is now in the favour of the bowler as opposed to in favour of the batsman.
I don't know if this will resonate with a lot of the listeners, but like for those who do know, like rugby's league or union, it is kind of like a low slow wicket is kind of like playing a match in the rain a little bit. It brings both sides together and makes attacking skills far more difficult. So once someone gets ahead, it's very difficult to come back, and I hope there'll be a stats piece to back this up, but I feel like, having written a lot of match reports for Crick Info on the BBL this summer, that the number of times where after the second power play, you can start writing the report a little bit with respect to both teams, has been a little bit startling. And that's because I think with low slow wickets, once one team gets ahead from a batting point of view, because of those defensive bowling skills, it's so easy to get guys to come on and bowl, set a deep point and just get them to bowl short into the wicket outside the off stump, concede the single. And, that's why I think we haven't had those last over finishes as well. You know, like, it's hard for batting teams to engineer comebacks back into the match, partly because of these wickets.
Yeah. And that's something that Australian cricket needs to find more Ashton Turners, guys with the ability to go up and down the gears in the middle overs. Glenn Maxwell is the obvious example, but there hasn't been that many developed within Australian cricket, and that's something, maybe that is one of the positives that might come out of this. We've seen Josh Phillippe do it a little bit for the Sixers. We might get some players who develop from that. On players, it's another interesting topic, is the clash with the Australian international season. Both you guys have touched on this already. But the BBL and national selection for Australian teams in particular, but it also sort of falls a little bit for, given how much international cricket's going on elsewhere in terms of getting overseas players in. It's a big hot topic here in Australia, and it's something that I know a lot of non-Australians would be interested in. How to balance test match cricket that's going on at the same time as BBL cricket, and how guys prepare and how they come in and come out. Because the IPL doesn't have this issue. A number of the leagues don't have this particular issue that Australia has to deal with. One example I wanted to raise, there was a few this year, Mitch Marsh, Peter Hanscom during the India Test Series, Jai Richardson, Ashton Turner got called up for ODI duty, didn't end up playing, but he's been pulled into the ODI series for the India tour coming up. Marcus Harris is prepped for the Sri Lanka series, and Marcus Stoinis was called up into the Sri Lanka squad. But the one for me was Mitch Marsh. He's a bit of a whipping boy in Australian cricket, Mitch Marsh. But I felt like he really got done a disservice this year in terms of his form. He was barely able to play any practice matches with the Scorchers ahead of the first BBL game because he was in the test squad for the first two tests, didn't play against India. Missed out in the first BBL game on a poor surface at Marvel where his team was bowled out for 103. Got called up to the Boxing Day test on no form to play. Didn't get any runs, got dropped after Boxing Day, had to stay on for Sydney and was a chance to play and had to prepare for test cricket, but then didn't play and then missed four games for the Scorchers in the meantime over that Christmas New Year period, and then was asked to slot straight back in, captain, be a key player in their top order. I feel like that's symptomatic of, well, a great example of the challenge that the Australian selectors and Australian players have. Sam, have you got any thoughts, given you're talking to a number of these guys?
Yeah, I do, and I recognise I'm probably going to come across as a little bit harsh here. So I do sympathise with how difficult it must be to prepare for two formats of the game that are completely different. But the way I see it is that, like, this is so soon going to become the new normal that I can't, like, they can have my sympathies, but they simply need to learn to adapt, I think. And I just can't see a scenario where, apart from maybe a few little tweaks here and there where a player might be protected for a test match or whatnot upon request, I do think this is the new normal. I think sometimes it can work in favour, but perhaps it's kind of retrospective. I mean, Pete Hanscom was dropped from the side, went and made 70 for the Stars and came back into the side. I do think these Australian selectors sometimes, they can use these things to their own advantage, I suppose. But, I have a little bit of sympathy, but I do think it's something that we're just going to have to get used to and players will have to get used to as well.
Yeah, quite an interesting point I thought was made by Greg Borman in his piece about the Big Bash that, this is not a young tournament anymore. This has been going for 8 years and, the comparison that he made was, the World Series Cup as part of the Australian summer. By the time it was 8 years old, that was sort of the peak of it really in terms of fan interest, crowds, television, all that kind of thing. It was well and truly established. You know, that's where Dean Jones was his point. That was where Dean Jones became a star about that time. Now, so to be still talking about how the player's going to adjust to it, knowing that it's there every season is, I think there's some cause to discuss it, but I think probably the main or the bigger issue I see anyway is ensuring that in the lead into a season, the players can prepare themselves physically, mentally, technically in such a way that they go into the season full of running and confident and knowing their games. And so then once they're doing that, they can then transition more smoothly from format to format. One of the things we saw with Australian players this season was that the amount of jumps between formats for a number of those guys, particularly guys that we're talking about that are sort of on the fringes and playing bits and pieces, was completely and utterly ridiculous. I think it was, well, certainly Glenn Maxwell was like 6 or 7 format changes before he played a Shield game at the start of this season. And that, to me, is far less sustainable than the Big Bash sitting in the school holidays underneath Test cricket.
Finch had 8, playing in 15 cities from memory. I remember writing the piece just before the last ODI, he had 8 format changes going across Test cricket, starting in the UAE, coming back and playing for the Renegades. And it certainly affected him. And talking to one of his teammates the other day, he could see it affecting him significantly.
You wouldn't want to be a fringe player, would you? I mean, no. If you get caught on the wrong side of selections, like if you're Peter Siddle, for example, I mean, you're a victim of your own success in many ways. If you're just outside the side, it can, by coincidence, sometimes just cost you months of cricket. You know, you can just be sitting there as 12th or 13th man, and then you can come to a BBL game, fly quickly into a BBL game. If you lose the toss or have a bit of bad luck, you miss out there, and then you're kind of in no man's land, and all of a sudden you're not up in lights, and you don't have the opportunity to even be in form or out of form, just by virtue of luck. So it's just a funny one. You hope it's a double-edged sword and that there are people who can take advantage of those things as well. But, I guess it's one of those things. I mean, one option that might sound ridiculous is the Bukowski approach of just nominating out of it and not playing formats that you don't think are going to help your cricket. It's so congested, isn't it, from a playing point of view?
So what's the solution from a schedule side of things? It's something you've written about. You're talking to people, Dan. How do they solve? I think this year was particularly vexed with the South Africa series wedged into November, the ODI series, the India T20s, and then the Sri Lanka tests running in January, which is a rare occurrence these days for Australian test matches in Australia to be hosted back end of January and Feb.
Yeah, well, ironically, the Sri Lanka tests were in the slot that quite often the second half of an India series is, although this year that India managed to turn up a little bit earlier than they usually do. But look, the in terms of the international schedule, there is an element of chaos to that, and Cricket Australia not being able to control that all of the time. However, I think the concept of shifting around where you're going to have the one-day domestic tournament, I think that's a big part of sort of realistic adjustments that can be made to improve things, so that you have it, you have some of it at the start of the season alongside the Shield, and you have some of it immediately after the Big Bash, but before you go back to Shield, which allows one of the long-running problems of the Big Bash to be assuaged, in that players generally and pace bowlers in particular get something they can build back up to Shield cricket with straight after concluding the Big Bash, in terms of how they're bowling and how, in terms of how they're training, just their mental preparation for a different style of bowling. So that's something that's in discussion that may well happen for next season. And then I think that, you know, this goes back, and it goes hand in hand with the whole concept of what's the ideal length of the Big Bash and the ideal starting point of the Big Bash. Having the Shield played, whether it's seven rounds or six rounds, played up until sort of the week before Christmas, that is much more, I think it's much more equitable for players in terms of contention for the Test team. It's better for the Big Bash League in terms of they're not trying to draw crowds in pre-Christmas when people are spending their money on a lot of other things. It leaves players with a lot more certainty in terms of how much opportunity they get to be thinking in terms of Test cricket before the Big Bash starts.
I think as I said earlier, one of the positives of this year is that we've got to the final stage. There are Test and international players from Australia available for this back end of the tournament, that it would be advisable for Cricket Australia to try and find a scenario whereby they can get their Test and international players available for a portion of the back end of the Big Bash every year.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think everybody would agree with that. Whether or not, as some people have been suggesting, the competition was extended so that this might happen and that, you know, all the haters can now, you know, eat humble pie, I'm not really quite sure about that. But I think, yeah, it's probably trite to say, but there's no doubt that seeing the best Australian players playing in the finals of the Big Bash is something that feels right for, you know, what is the golden goose of Australian cricket.
So. There's no question that there was that was not a happy accident. That runs alongside of Cricket Australia's, you know, strategic. We want to own more of the season. We want to have a bigger footprint relative to footy. We want the Big Bash to run into the middle of February for that reason. If we conclude international cricket by the end of January, that gives us 2 weeks where we've got all of our players and we're in complete control of that pointy end, and allowing the tournament to have a finale rather than just a fade out. And I think that's something that's been central to the minds of Cricket Australia's thinkers for a few years now. And having, you know, having Pat Cummins turn out for the Thunder was, it was great in terms of, you know, just seeing images of him wearing the Thunder gear at the end of the season that he'd had. That's going to have, you know, that will literally cause kids to want to go to the cricket.
I think more than that, the fact that he bowled to the two best players in the tournament, the two form players, and got the better of them, was something that's worthwhile looking at. We have the best players going up against the best. The example, Maxwell facing Lyon the other day, was tremendous viewing, and Maxie getting the better of him again was a great example of how we separate our best players from the rest. Let's have a chat about a couple of teams that really struggled this year, the Strikers and the Scorchers. The Strikers, the defending champions, don't get the chance to defend their title in the finals, and the Scorchers have never missed the finals, and they have done this year. Tristan Lavallette, a colleague of ours, has written a great piece about the struggles of the Scorchers. Have you guys got any take on what you've seen from them this year and why they've struggled so much?
Look, not really. I suppose I know Nick Cummins from the Hobart Hurricanes has coined his own franchise, Scorchers 2.0. So perhaps the Scorchers are kind of yesterday. They feel a little bit tired. It feels like a tired franchise. I understand that there's no real description to that, but I suppose the flickering embers of Maxie Klinger's career kind of might have a little bit of a symbol of that. Perhaps they just need a little bit of regeneration. They've had such a, you know, they've created such a legacy around their performances in the BBL over the last seven or so years that you can almost forgive them an off year or whatnot. Perhaps it's the, you know, no involvement of Justin Langer or whatnot, but it's really hard to say. I'm sure they'll be back because they've essentially been that they've flown the flag. You know, they've been the great, the best performing BBL franchise throughout the 8 years it's been around. So maybe we can just forgive them one.
I think they, yeah, with Justin at the helm, they were operating not just the Scorchers, but the WA system was operating at a very sort of high pitch of discipline and intensity and consistency over an extended period of time. And I think, yeah, partly there would have been an element of, you know, everyone just exhaling a bit and sort of, you know, like anyone feels at the end of a long stint of doing a lot of hard work. Yeah, there is a bit of a come down from that. So I think that's part of it. I think, the fact that Justin is with the Australian team and then all of a sudden the Scorchers find it a little bit more difficult to retain a couple of players, you know, I found that significant. You know, how much better they would have gone if they'd had, Philippe, involved in their team, because I know initially he wasn't going to be offered a full contract, but that didn't mean that he wouldn't have found himself involved in the team once they had ins and outs with various players going off to play international cricket and whatnot. That would have made a big difference. But the other thing that I think is a huge factor with the Scorchers that Tristan did write about is Perth Stadium, and they knew intimately how to play the whacker and play it to their best advantage. And I was there for the semi-final last year where they lost very unexpectedly to the Hurricanes. It's just a different ground. It requires a different style of cricket to play, and maybe their list wasn't necessarily the best list to play at Perth Stadium relative to playing at the Wacker.
I would agree with that. They certainly had their trouble trying to work out what was a winning score at Perth Stadium and whether or not to bat first or chase. It was something that they debated heavily every single time they walked out. The trouble was the inconsistency of their top order. Michael Klinger obviously had a really tough year, but they had injuries to Josh Inglis, Sam Whiteman. They couldn't quite balance out what they would do while Sean Marsh was away. They wrestled with where to bat Ashton Turner. Mitch Marsh's form was an issue as well. And yeah, it was just one of those years for them. They'll need to reset. The strikers is an interesting one. I just ran some numbers earlier. So to me, it looks like a pretty simple equation, really. Last season, Travis Head, Alex Carey, Jake Weatherall, and Colin Ingram combined for 200s and 10 half centuries in 11 games. This year, between the four of them, over 14 games, only 950s, and all the strike rates were well down between the four of them, and Head only played the three matches. Peter Siddle and Rashid Khan played 11 games each last year, 29 wickets, economy rates of under 6 for both of them this year, 25 wickets between the two of them. Rashid's RPO was 6.14, which for him is expensive, but across the board is outstanding in any case. But Siddle in six games gave up 7.77 and over. And Sam, you touched on it earlier. I mean, Siddle's year, it's just been so interrupted. He's barely played, and unfortunately for any cricketer, they're designed to play, they want to play, and when you don't get to play, it's hard to get continuity and rhythm and form.
Mm. Yeah, the strikers, I mean, are probably the second biggest institution, I think, of in BBL cricket so far. You know, always a resplendent Adelaide Oval welcomes them, a very, very partisan crowd that makes no sound whenever the opposition hits a boundary or does anything good, which is quite eerie. And at the start of the season, I actually thought they looked specials again. You know, Jason Gillespie is a very heralded coach on the rise, you know, a very modern kind of thinker of the game. He's doing well over in England as well, you know, close to the Aussie job as well, I understand. And then through, yeah, Ingram, Head, Carey and Weatherall, there's a nucleus of an excellent batting unit who started well but then just kind of fell away. And even at the start of the season, Rashid Khan, he looked unplayable. You know, most teams you felt like had to score their runs off 16 overs because Khan had to be seen off, and then he kind of disappeared for a little bit, you know, due to personal circumstances and otherwise, and, you know, returned, certainly, you know, without as much, kind of penetration and as much danger as he had before, and the team sort of seemed to fall away with him. Travis Head came on in Test cricket, so he didn't appear as much for the strikers. Obviously, Peter Siddle was all over the place. So, yeah, I think a few of those factors kind of account for their slide down the table.
Yeah, the absence of Travis Head, not only as a batsman but as a captain, I think that's a huge factor. Colin Ingram, interestingly enough, if you look at his numbers, they're basically identical to last season in terms of the amount of runs he provided at what speed. But yeah, not having Travis Head there, I think that leaves a huge hole, like I say, not only in terms of batting but leadership. Someone who had, you know, it makes an interesting contrast was Liam O'Connor. Liam O'Connor only played in the Big Bash League final last year, and did a very good job in the circumstances, four overs, none for 27. You come to this season and he plays seven games and he doesn't do terribly, but he's shown over the course of needing to play games in a row that, their ability to get him up and about to do a job in one game versus needing to do it consistently over eight games demonstrated a bit of a gap in quality. And the other one is Ben Lachlan. Ben Lachlan was around about as economical this season as he was last season, but his supply of wickets really dropped away. And one of the things we know about this Big Bash League is that it's been far lower scoring than it was last year, which meant that the outstanding bowlers for the Strikers were so far ahead of the rest, and they all came back to the field collectively. And there's not one member of the Strikers bowling attack who was better this year than they were last year.
That's good analysis. Let's go to the top of the table. The Hurricanes, the best side in it by a mile in the home and away season. They'll have a challenge, though, in this final series. Their form has tailed off a little bit, but you basically wrote the book on it, Sam, the Scorchers 2.0. You wrote a great piece about it earlier in the year. You've spoken to many people at the franchise. What insights did you glean from their rise from their run to the final last year, which was a bit unexpected, to now becoming a really bankable top-of-the-table franchise?
Yeah, and you're right. They have been the best team in the home away season by a long way. In fact, they seem to be the only side that kind of carries remnants of what we remember the BBL to be. You know what I mean? They still have that very kind of partisan crowd down at Blundstone, etc., and they have guys who are performing really well that you can kind of bank on. You know when you watch them that you're probably going to see something exciting. So they've definitely held the candle for BBL this year. Speaking to a few people within the franchise, they certainly think that a lot of their success is down to that Scorchers 2.0 idea of being a one-program team, of being able to keep continuity, which was a word I heard a lot between the Tassie team and the Hobart team, that the only players that they bring in from the outside is Jofra Archer, of course, Darcy Short, and I think David Moody as well has come over from WA. They had, there might have been one or two others as well, but I understand that they're kind of almost regarded as overseas players who come in, even if they are, some of them are from Australia. But they think the continuity element works really well. And the other thing that I gleaned was that they select on role. And so by that, it was explained to me that there are a lot of teams out there, I'd probably say the Melbourne Stars, perhaps the Brisbane Heat as well, who certainly take the approach of picking the best players and then retrofitting them into a side and working out how to get a combination out of that, whereas the Hurricanes are very focused on who will do which particular role. And I think an interesting kind of contrast, especially heading into this semi, which, you know, is probably bad radio because as you listen to it, it's already been played, but James Faulkner for the Hurricanes versus Dwayne Bravo for the Stars is probably an example of, the Hurricanes having a player who's specifically picked for a role, whereas Dwayne Bravo, who kind of was just brought in from the Renegades to the Stars, was just purchased by the Stars because he was just a great player who brought people to the game. Watching those two philosophies go into battle on Thursday will be very interesting.
Someone else who I think should rate a mention, obviously there's a lot of talk about Griffith and his influence down there, and I think probably it's helped the Tasmanian program entirely to keep him, that he was able to become the Hurricanes coach as well, and obviously, you know, that makes it a full season job with better remuneration. But Jeff Vaughan, the batting coach for both Tasmania and the Hurricanes, he's, in terms of three players that I can pick out, he's been hugely influential in Australian cricket in recent times. The formative batting coach for Travis Head, the batting coach who brought Tim Payne back from the brink of retirement, essentially in terms of regaining confidence in his method and how he was going to bat, to the point that while he continues to maintain that drought of making hundreds, he's been an extremely reliable and consistent batsman for Australia at Test level when he's absolutely needed to be. And the last one is Matthew Wade, who has been, is now the subject of almost as much debate as Glenn Maxwell, which is saying something given that Maxie's ability to dominate the airwaves in terms of should he be picked, should he not be picked for various forms. And, you know, a lot of that is down to Vaughan's ability as a batting coach to find the right methods for each individual player to be their best.
They've had an outstanding tournament so far. Remains to be seen, as you mentioned, Sam. It's bad podcasting doing this ahead of the finals, but they've certainly set the standard. I wouldn't underestimate the legacy of Gary Kirsten either, even though it's a year down the track he's left the franchise. But his IP, his knowledge, and some of the things he did in particular with Darcy Short, developing batting craft around his hitting, was exceptional, and Short can thank Gary for that. Guys, it's been a fascinating discussion. There's obviously a lot more we could talk about, but we might end it there. Just get your final thoughts on basically how you would rate this year's edition compared to the rest.
I would describe it as educational this year, which I think is being kind of kind. I think the criticism and the general sense that it's not what it could have been is warranted. But similarly, I don't think that Cricket Australia disagrees with that. I don't want to be a mouthpiece for Cricket Australia, but it does bear remembering that as far as domestic cricket goes, it's still an incredible product. And I do think, to be fair to fans, a lot of the gripes recognise that. They recognise what the BBL can be. And I think that I actually do think they'll fix it. I'm a BBL optimist.
The word I'd use is transitional. And I think that what most people need to find an understanding about is that there is one thing that is not a variable about the Big Bash League. That is the number of games. That's set in stone for the terms of the broadcast agreements, that it stays at 59 games. However, anything other than that can be adjusted, can be tweaked, can be worked on, can be whether it's finding a better way to get international or overseas players involved, whether it's changing the number of games per day so that the tournament's not played over so many days, it's which venues matches played at, what sort of drop-in pitch have they got at Docklands, given that what's going on at the MCG concurrently? I think that's a relevant debate. So there's a whole lot of things that Cricket Australia, the clubs and the state associations can do together in the knowledge that other than the games being a fixed number, there's plenty of flexibility.
Well, thank you to you both, Dan, Sam, for your thoughts today. They've been superb, and I hope you enjoyed listening to ESPN Cricket Info's Talking T20 podcast, a deep dive into the BBL. We hope you enjoy the BBL final series, and we'll hope to speak to you again soon. Thanks for listening.